means it is time for American DA Live with Commonwealth Attorney Ray Larson. Ray, good morning.
Good morning, Jack.
Sure, I'm not alone in saying that the cases that get me the most upset are cases that involve abuse of children. The good news is we don't talk about them very often on this show, thank goodness, because I don't like hearing about them any more than anybody else, and you don't like talking about them more than anybody else. But I think there's important information to be disseminated today about, I guess, our responsibilities as society and just this whole subject of child abuse. Tell us who you brought with you this morning.
Well, we're going to talk about the case of Commonwealth versus Cheryl Christopher and her husband, Elijah Christopher. And Cindy Reeker is one of our senior prosecutors and most experienced prosecutors, and she handled this case. And it has to do with children who were adopted by this couple. And so we're going to talk to Cindy about the case. But I also think it's very important that we talk about our community's response to children and crimes mm-hmm. against children and how all of that works. Jesse Harris is with us, and he spent many, many years in charge of the Crimes Against Children's Unit and is now the super snoop over at Internal Affairs for the Lexington Division of Police.
And I like that new job better than that old job, I'll tell you.
Yeah, and Mary Houlihan, who everybody who listens to this show knows, is in charge of our victim services mm-hmm. in our office, but in her prior life, she was involved in the investigation of child fatalities and child abuse and those kind of things. And so from this group, we're going to hear about we're going to introduce the whole subject through this case involving this Christopher couple. And then we want to talk about the responsibilities that have been undertaken by the police department in the Crimes Against Children's Unit. And then, so what does this Cabinet for Families and Children do? I think mm-hmm. I got that title right.
Yeah.
Because they change it about every 20 minutes.
Well, it's a state. You
know. Yeah. And Mary can do that because she's been there and done that.
Sure.
So, Cindy, welcome.
Good morning, Cindy.
Good morning.
And why don't you bring us up to date about this case, if you would.
All right. This case originated back in 2010, actually, when the allegations were made from the children involved, who were adopted children for both of the Christophers. One of the female victims in the case was 9 years old at the time, and the other one was 11 years old. And they were participating in some therapy and began to make allegations of some criminal conduct in the home with particularly Miss Christopher. And so the police got involved based upon a referral from the Cabinet on that and began their investigation. And what they learned through their interviews with the children, and there were three other children in the home.
Total of five?
Total of yeah. five children in the home, three boys and two girls.
Okay.
And the girls primarily were the victim in Fayette County. And the girls began to tell the police about some instances in which their mother locked them. They had a lot of dogs in the house, some Dobermans and some other types of dogs, I believe. And the girls began to allege that the mother would lock them in the cages with the dogs and wouldn't let them out, would lock them in their room and would padlock the door from the outside so that they couldn't get out. And oftentimes the cages were in the room locked, and they were locked in the cage as well.
Hmm.
The girls also alleged that their mother would duct tape their eyes and mouth and put a bag over their head and threaten them. On one occasion, they even said that she had told them to get up on the roof and jump off the roof, and they wouldn't do it, so she got up there with them and allegedly pushed them off of the roof. And so lots of allegations by the girls. Detective Root with the Crimes Against Children Unit was the investigator in the case, and he actually went into the home, and she had been evicted from the home at some point, the family had, but they'd gone back and they were able to see evidence where the locks had been on the outside of the door, and neighbors verifying that there were cages. And
Where was it? What part of town?
St. Anthony? Mm-hmm. St. Anthony. Now, I'm not sure exactly where that's located, Jack.
Is that off
over behind Adelauer?
Mm-hmm. In the Adelauer subdivision.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So both of the Christophers were interviewed by the police, and Ms. Christopher denied any conduct, criminal conduct, as it related to these children. Her husband did allege that there was one incident into which he interceded, and the girls had told about that incident and that she had stabbed him with a knife. And the children verified that, and he did too, of course. So anyway, from those allegations, then the charges were brought. The grand jury heard the case and ended up indicting both of the Christophers on criminal abuse in the first degree, which was a C felony, unlawful imprisonment in the first degree, which was a D felony, and wanton endangerment in the first degree, which were also D felonies. And from there, we began our process, and it was actually set for trial at one point. Mr. Christopher his health became really bad during the pendency of the case, and he really was hard for him to deal with his attorney in the case. So we really, the plea bargaining process in his case kind of broke down because he was just unwilling and unable to work with his attorney. And Ms. Christopher just maintained her innocence throughout as we were going along. The girls in the case who were the charged victims were placed in foster homes. And began to thrive and do really, really well. And they moved past all of this, which was what children do. And as we set it for trial, it became obvious in working with the social workers and the foster parents that these girls were, it was going to be very difficult for them to testify, to sit into a courtroom and look at them and have to tell what happened. And so negotiations began with Ms. Christopher, and she was actually willing at some point then to enter a guilty plea, to which she did. And Mr. Christopher passed away during the pendency of this case. And so she ended up entering a guilty plea to criminal abuse in the second degree, two counts with a recommendation of 1 year, and then two counts of wanton endangerment in the second degree, 6 months on each of those counts. She entered what we call a plea pursuant to Alford versus North Carolina, which is essentially she would not admit her guilt, but admit that there was enough evidence to find her guilty of the crime.
And that's called an Alford plea.
It is called an Alford plea, yeah. Yes. Uh-huh. And so that's what she entered. We had conditions of that plea. And one of the conditions, there had been an ongoing termination of parental rights as it related to these children. And she had lost her parental rights to the children. They were adopted, so they were legally hers. And she had appealed that to the Court of Appeals, and as a condition of the plea, she had to withdraw her appeal of the termination of her parental rights. And so that was a process. The sentencing kind of was continued for a while because that just didn't happen for whatever reason, and I'm not sure why. And we weren't willing to allow her to be sentenced until that happened. And so just recently that did happen, and the appeal was dismissed as it related to the two victims in this case. And so she was sentenced last week by Judge Goodwine. And Judge Goodwine sentenced her to 2 years in prison and was very firm with her during the sentencing. And it was a good sentencing hearing because she was she recognized that Mary will talk about the foster parents had sent in victim impact letters, which were so important in this case because the judge didn't get to hear that side of the case when the guilty plea took place. And so the judge recognized that these children were thriving out of that home. And she made a point of telling Ms. Christopher that, you know, she was their mother and she should have cared for them and loved them. And if she was going to... there was some allegation that maybe some of this happened because she was disciplining the children and that's not how you discipline children. And throughout the case, Ms. Christopher tried to allege that these children had psychological and mental problems. In fact, she'd had them write in notebooks things about killing animals and the devil and things like that. I think probably, and Jesse probably agree with me on this, just to protect herself in the end, to place the blame on the children. But when they went into treatment, they didn't experience any of these psychological issues at all, which was very telling in the case, because a child who has psychological issues isn't going to overcome that, and they're going to experience and mm-hmm. manifest those things, and that just didn't happen. So so the victim impact statement was wonderful.
We're taking a break. Commonwealth Attorney Ray Larson with us, Assistant Commonwealth Attorney Cindy Reeker, Detective Jesse Harris, and Victims Advocate Mary Houlihan in the studio. We're talking about a child abuse case here in Fayette County. Ray?
Mary, Cindy was talking about the issues involving these children and the trauma of testifying in a case. Talk to us a little bit, if you would, from the victim's perspective, the child victim's perspective, about the difficulty that children create in these kind of situations, and why we almost always have to come down to a decision about whether or not we're going to kick the dog stuffing out of somebody, or do we have to, as we say, negotiate a plea for the welfare of these kids.
Well, interestingly, I believe probably the radio audience is feeling like the victim right now, because even given what Cindy described, if you don't know a lot about the law, then you feel like, wow, listen to all that they did, and then you're saying 1 year and 6 months or these kind of sentences that the general public doesn't understand the connections and the limitations on our prosecutors. Certainly, if we had our ability to follow through on the kind of outcomes we feel when we read these cases, the criminal justice system would be a very different place. But as it is, not only did Cindy have to deal with the fact that allegations and things that are being told having happened in the past, while we can believe those things and absolutely think that they occurred and believe the victims and support them, that does not mean that those are things that will end up in a court of law or can be proven. And that's a huge limitation that's on our prosecutors. So one of the things they have to do in these situations involving vulnerable children is evaluate the damage that's going to be caused additionally to the children in being pulled through a criminal justice system, to learn about things they can and can't say. Well, that can't be said because we have no proof. This is hearsay. These are things that children cannot get their minds around. To be honest, a lot of adults cannot get their minds around. And then know that you're causing the psychological damage of exposing them to the very people that caused all the harm in the first place. So what Cindy's describing there is walking that fine line and making a balanced approach that both takes into consideration the fact that these children are thriving, not putting them through additional victimization, and then also what she did in this case, that having come from Child Protective Services, I admire so much, is she made part of the plea take some of the stuffing out of what was happening in family court, where this woman would have appeal rights to get out of jail or to get out of this criminal situation and then go back after trying to become parent to these children again. Cindy put a stop to that by making part of the appeal be that she part of the plea be that she take out her appeal to become their parent again. And think, our radio audience, what you would think if you heard not only about the punishment that she faced, but that when she got out of jail, she went right back out and the law allows her to become parent again. And there would not have been any given that would not have occurred. So there's just a lot to consider here. And what she mainly did was focus on, these kids have been through enough. How can I have a positive outcome that puts a record in place of what she did, limits her from being able to adopt or have this sort of impact on the lives of other children, protect the children that were originally hurt. And I really think the conclusion in this case handled all of those things, even if it doesn't sound like the amount of time any of us would wish would occur.
More coming up in just a moment. 253-5959, touch star 590 from AT&T. Toll free from anywhere, 1-877-777-0590, or email JackPatty@WVLK8. As we're talking about a child abuse case that happened here in Fayette County, Commonwealth Attorney Ray Larson is with us, along with Assistant Commonwealth's Attorney Cindy Reeker, Detective Jesse Harris, and the victim's advocates in charge of that division of the office, Mary Houlihan, is with us this morning. And Ray,
Jesse, let's. I want to talk about how, because Cindy mentioned that these children were in some sort of therapy, and began to make these allegations that subsequently turned into an investigation and a prosecution and a guilty plea and a sentencing and a prison sentence. Tell us how does the Crimes Against Children Unit work with the Cabinet for Families and Children, and how do you all get involved in these kind of investigations, and sort of pick it up, if you would, about from the therapy to all of a sudden it's in Crimes Against Children's Unit's responsibility.
Okay, right. Well, we are mandated by statute to co-investigate cases with the Cabinet for Health and Family Services, so we investigate cases with them all the time. We're pursuing the case through criminal jurisdictions, and they pursue it through civil, through like family court, but we're still relying on the same information and the same types of evidence in the cases, statements from the victims and so forth. So we start out with them right off the bat conducting the investigations. We conduct interviews together and other parts of the investigation. So it's a close working relationship. We get information from them, they get information from us. But generally someone will call either the police department or the cabinet to report a case of child abuse, and then we start right there with the different steps of the investigation. Let me also say that just in general, law enforcement officers dread these types of investigations.
I bet.
Because child abuse is just different from every other type of crime that there is, and that's basically because we're relying on information from small children to try to prove our case. In other types of cases, it's more physical evidence based. So, right. So makes them just difficult. There's also an emotional toll that goes along with conducting child abuse investigations. That's why we have specialists like our Crimes Against Children detectives who are specially trained, and they train with the cabinet as well to do these types of investigations. But we just respond to the reports as they are, and then start trying to make the best decisions we can, either through criminal charges or taking action through the family court to pursue the cases there.
One, in this case, some of the allegations were being kept in a cage and the lock being locked into the room from the outside, that sort of thing. And Jim Root, who's a detective with the Crimes Against Children's Unit, I guess when he started investigating, he was looking for things that would corroborate those allegations, because after all, we're dealing with young people. And their credibility is basically, Jack, when you go in and a child testifies against an adult and a jury has to decide credibility, far too often the juries go with the one that's the most articulate and has that sort of thing. And so as a result, it's the corroboration of allegations, finding evidence to support what these children said, is critical in these kind of cases. And did I understand that evidence to support those allegations was in fact found?
It was. Yeah, when children are abused, they don't take record of what happened. And sometimes the abuse occurs over months and even years, as it did in this case. So when they try to disclose what happened, it's a jumbled mess sometimes in their mind, because they can't remember every instance and how it happened and where it happened. So when we try to get that information from them, sometimes that information is very disjointed. They'll talk about this abuse that happened here, and then they're trying to talk about some other form of abuse that happened 2 years ago. So their facts are sometimes get muddled. So it's very important that we get any corroboration that we can to support what they're saying and try to verify what they're saying. And that's the steps that the detective has to take. They receive that initial disclosure from the child, and then they try to corroborate it in any way they can. And in this case, like Ray alluded to earlier, there were statements about dog kennels and that sort of thing. We were able to go back and find witnesses who had actually seen dog kennels in the room. There were allegations that the children had been locked in a room from the outside. And so we were able to verify that, in fact, there had been locks placed on the outside of the bedroom doors and that sort of thing, which is very uncommon. You know, so that was something that was we were able to use to corroborate those victim statements.
One of the things that sounded like it was potentially the most dangerous of all the allegations was being almost thrown off a roof. Mm-hmm. And that could have obviously killed those children. I guess there was no way to prove that, was there?
Right. There was, yeah. Again, we had a report of that, but no eyewitness. That's the thing about child abuse, too. They're rarely done in front of witnesses, so it makes it even more difficult.
You know, Jesse has dealt with some of the, in his role as a former supervisor of the Crimes Against Children's Unit, has dealt with some of the most troubling cases we've ever dealt with. And one comes to mind, and that's the rape of this 2-year-old child. By this Brian, what was his name?
That escapes me off the top of my head.
Well, and the child died.
Crabtree.
Yeah,
Brian Crabtree.
And what our prosecutors have done, and I really admire Cindy and the senior prosecutors in our office, because they're the ones that typically have to deal with these difficult cases. Cindy and Luanna Redcorn and those folks have really deal with these things, and I admire their ability to do it and to stay focused, because that's the key. And one of the things that's very important on this thing is keeping the families involved with us, because they don't understand the criminal justice system.
And in this case, these kids didn't have parents to back them up. The parents were the bad guys, so they didn't have a support system. You became their support system.
Well, the people that were directly involved in the case, the social workers at different levels, both therapeutically, CASA volunteers, which is a court-appointed special advocate that works in the family court system to just have a say for what would be in the best interest of the child, the cabinet workers, all sorts of people that are also impacted. While they don't have to come forward, and they certainly have huge and overburdened caseloads, in this case, once the defendant pled guilty, they provided victim impact statements to the judge, and that's what Cindy referenced earlier. Those statements, sometimes in a guilty plea, there hadn't been a trial, so there hasn't been all of this evidence coming forward for the judge to consider. Those statements are just huge at that point to give the judge a look at the fact, what's behind the plea, the legal definition of what occurred, what's the personal loss or impact on the child. In this case, one of the CASA volunteers said, one of the children in the termination of parental rights hearing said something along the lines of, if I had known about social workers sooner, I would have put a stop to all of this long ago. As brave as that statement was, the truth is there is no reason a child should have to be responsible for stopping the abuse occurring in their home. And I love that line, not only because it clearly impacted the judge, but because it is all of our legal responsibility, the legal responsibility of the public, not to know for sure that abuse is happening, but if you suspect something, to report it, to speak up for the children that are oftentimes unable to speak up for themselves. So we would like to make sure and give the number for reporting child abuse and neglect to the Cabinet for Health and Family Services, which is 877-597-2331. Obviously, if what you're suspecting is an imminent risk, you can also call our police department. But just make sure that you don't have to know for sure that something's occurring. But sometimes these small glimpses we have into children's lives, if you feel like something's right, you're not going to hurt anybody by reporting it. You just might save a child's life.
You know, I was at a store one time, one of those big box stores, and I saw a woman absolutely thrashing some kid, and I went up and stopped it. And far too often, we've all seen people, you know, treating a kid the way they shouldn't be treated, and most of the time we just think, well, that's none of my business. Well,
It is our business.
Yeah, it should be. Yeah, okay. I'm surprised that woman didn't whip my rear end. She could have.
We're going to take a break. 253-5959. Touch star 590 from AT&T. Toll free from anywhere. 253-5959. Touch star 590 from AT&T. Toll free from anywhere. 1-877-777-0590. Email jackpatty at wvlkam.com. And this is Sharon. Good morning, Sharon.
Good morning, Jack. I want to address something she just said.
Okay.
Back in 2007, I knew of a case where a boy was being abused. He was 17 years old. The state had been in and out of his house for years. They were all under state surveillance. There were social workers assigned. There were therapists assigned. They diagnosed him as bipolar, schizophrenic, manic depressive, the whole nine yards. What he was abused by his stepfather. So at one point, I did manage to get him into family court. His mother asked me to take him after a big blow-up at the house. They were trying to figure out what was best for him. And the family court judge threatened to throw me in jail for parental interference, even though I was asked by his mother. So this is why people are so hesitant to jump in and get involved. At that point, I didn't care if I went to jail or not. When a boy shows up and his arms are cut all the way up to his shoulders, somebody needs to do something. When he can't stay awake because he's on Trilipdol and Prozac and sleeping pills because he has all these diagnoses. But like I said, once you reach a certain age, they really don't care. His social worker looked at me and said, he only has 8.5 more months of this. Can't he just put up with it?
Mary?
Well, I can certainly understand and appreciate where you're coming from with the frustration and limitation on what can be done when you feel like you know abuse is occurring. But I can also tell you that no matter how much I tried in my role as a child abuse investigator, there were certainly situations I was involved with where I was doing the very best I could with the information and the legal limitations on what I could do that might have meant that somebody was out there describing me in that exact same way. People often ask me, you know, how can I do what I do dealing with violent crime all day, every day? But what I'll tell you is the very hardest part of what I do now and what I did with the cabinet is all the things you have to know, absolutely know, occurred and believe totally that occurred, but cannot bring into the court systems for whatever reasons the law does not allow. So, you know, I can't speak in particular to the individual situation that you're describing and exactly what happened there, just that I understand your frustration. And while I don't believe that any of that sort of frustration or any of the stories of the worst case scenario, not only does it not change the legal obligation to report, but you really have to remember that it shouldn't, that you can't not save other children in situations or speak up about other children in situations because you know of a case where help did not arrive. It's frustrating, but the path to help children still means that we all have to speak up and try. So you can know that you did everything you could by trying. It's not your responsibility to take on the job or the role that every other person has to do when they're responding to these cases, just that you have to report and you have to try.
Thank you, Sharon. 3 minutes left in the show, Ray, to wrap this up.
Well, we had a sentencing hearing finally for this Christopher defendant. And what? Tell us quickly about what does that all entail, and I want to know specifically about how important the victim impact statements were.
Well, the sentencing hearing is, of course, before the judge, and after a defendant like Ms. Christopher pleads guilty, the probation and parole office will interview her and prepare what is called a pre-sentencing investigation report, which basically talks about the life history of the defendant, and that is provided to to the court, and oftentimes the probation officer will make a recommendation as to whether or not they feel like probation might be appropriate for this individual based upon their history and the nature of the crime. In this particular case, the victim impact statement was very, very important because these children were in a terrible, terrible situation, and they were withdrawn. They really didn't have social skills. They cried a lot, and these children then went into a good home, a loving, caring home to which they are absolutely thriving. They're participating in sporting events. They're just doing so well. And so the judge needed to know that. So our part of a sentencing hearing is providing the court with the victim impact statements. So in this case, to let the judge know how the children are doing out of that home, which is also really good evidence in a case like this where she wasn't admitting her guilt.
Right.
Because children don't thrive like that if they really have problems. So Mary can speak to the impact statement.
We got 1 minute. So Mary, can you give us 15 seconds?
Just that, again, please continue to report. Don't look at the frustrations and limitations of the system, but think about what we each can do individually.
Were these two girls placed in the same home?
They are not. In separate homes? They're in separate homes, yes.
And what about the three boys?
I think that there were twin boys there in the same home, and I'm not sure about the third boy if he's with them or not.
But there were no allegations of abuse from the boys?
Not in Fayette County.
Okay, not in Fayette County. Excellent. Thank you guys for being with us. Thank you, Ray.
Okay.
Stand by. We have an update from ABC. If you're listening to WVLK AM, stay with us. We have Live with Lee coming up next. If you're tuned to 101.5 FM, The Coach's Show with Joe B. and Denny, have a great weekend, and I will be back Monday morning at 6, 5 Central.